taped on April 1st, 1988 in Busch Stadium in St. Louis. Okay, Bob, tell me now about where you were born, when, and where you grew up.
Well, born and raised St. Paul, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I came from a family of 10 children, and I was the youngest of 10. I had seven sisters and two other brothers. And the one brother was interested, became interested in training. He was working out at Lexington Ballpark in St. Paul, became interested in training, and was working with a fellow by the name of Mike Kelly, who was one of the managers at that time, mm-hmm. in the American Association.
Right.
And it was double-A ball, which is now triple-A ball. Mm-hmm. And I used to go out to the ballpark when I was a kid, roller skate from school and get out about the fourth or fifth inning and maybe help put scores on the scoreboard.
Sure.
I'd get about 25 cents a week for that. No, and I got interested in working around the clubhouse too. And in 1920, believe it or not, St. Paul had some good ball clubs at that time. And I worked around the clubhouse, used to wash uniforms, shine shoes, and all that. I was a clubhouse boy, too. Mm-hmm. So then later on, Mike Kelly sold the ball club to a fellow by the name of Bob Connery, and who worked with Miller Huggins and the Yankees. Mm-hmm. We weren't really a farm for them, but we worked with
them. Had a working agreement.
We found a working agreement with them. Mm-hmm. And I think Huggins at that time really had an interest in the St. Paul ball club with Bob Connery, who was a scout. He discovered Hornsby. You know, he picked
pretty good
Hornsby.
Scouting.
He was a very good scout. He was one of the best scouts in the country at that time. And then he bought the St. Paul Ball Club. And then my brother moved to Minneapolis, and I went to Minneapolis with him and worked with him in Minneapolis as clubhouse boy during my high school years. And at that time, I was going to Central High School in St. Paul. And to show you how I got started, it was during the winter time, a one-armed referee refereeing the hockey games out of the Hippodrome Rink in St. Paul, and I'm center ice for Central High School. I was captain my senior year. Mm-hmm. And this, my senior year, and he's getting ready to drop the puck, and he says, "I hear you're going to be training with the St. Paul Ball Club." Now that was news to me. I hadn't even thought, oh, here I'm a senior in high school,
yeah.
And I'm playing hockey. And at that time at night, I was working at the Minneapolis Arena skating rink. My brother was trainer with the Minneapolis Hockey Club, mm-hmm. and I used to help him. So I also worked at the rink over there. Then I got to thinking about that. I wasn't worth a damn in that hockey game that day, because I
understand.
Got to thinking about that. I said, what the?
Yeah.
So time went on. This was about the middle of winter. I'd say about somewhere in December, somewhere around in that. So one day I was sick at school. This is funny how things go. Mm-hmm. I was sick, and I went down to the nurse's room, which I very seldom do, and she said, "You've got a temperature, you better go home." I said, "Okay, I'll go home." I had been home a half hour, believe me, and the telephone rang, and it was at St. Paul. Secretary, a fellow by the name of Mac Mickey, was secretary of the St. Paul Baseball Club, and he says, "Mr. Connery would like to talk to you."
Yeah.
I says, "When do you want to see me?" "Well, as soon as possible." So, sick as I was, I left and went down the baseball office downtown St.
Sure.
Paul, went down there, and he says, he looked at me, I guess I must look terrible. I was a kid 19 years old. "Well, we've heard a lot about you. We'd like to hire you for a trainer for the St. Paul Baseball Club this spring." I said, "What?" I said, "Gee." And I couldn't say no.
No, absolutely.
I couldn't say no, but I thought, gee, how am I going to finish school? You know, I'm a senior this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to school and talked to my teachers. They said, "Go ahead. Take a job." I talked to the principal, who was a good friend of mine at the time. He said, "Bob," he says, "you can make up these classes at night school and that and get it." I said, "You go ahead and take the job." So I did.
Good.
So that's when I joined the St. Paul Ball Club.
I'm done.
And my brother was trained at Minneapolis at that time, Minneapolis. So we had a rivalry in the
family.
St. Paul, Minneapolis, Twin Cities.
Yeah.
Then I went south that spring with the St. Paul Ball Club.
Mm-hmm.
Some funny things happened. All the guys looked at me like I was. And my first roommate was Van Adel, who came out of Penn State,
mm-hmm.
left-hand pitcher the Yankees.
Russ.
And Russ Van Adel. Yeah, in fact, he just died here recently.
Mm-hmm.
And Russ, I could tell a lot of stories on him, which I will do. I think the first day in the. Funny thing happened first, I don't know whether you know Oscar Rutger or not. He really was
wrong. I remember the name,
Oscar,
yeah.
And he was first baseman.
Yeah.
He's one of the few ball players that went back to major leagues. He came down, the Yankees sent him down to St. Paul as a, he was a pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, make a first baseman out of him. And then he could hit one run worth a darn. And he was a wild pitcher, and so they wanted to make mm-hmm. a first baseman out of him. And he did a good job. He hit over 300 for St. Paul Ball Club.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the first day in spring training, he had a little clubhouse in Mineral Wells, Texas.
Yeah.
And that was the first, Mineral Wells, Texas. And I remember him, in those days, he didn't have anything to work with. And the first day, he had towels, and I brought a bunch of towels and a trunk down from St. Paul. I said, well, that's going to last a player a week before I get it cleaned. No, and Oscar was stepping on the towel the first day, and I said, hey, that towel's going to last you a week. Get off of it. Use it for your body.
Yeah.
And he says, what do you mean? Yeah, Oscar, you just come down to the Yankees, you know.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, it's going to last you a week. And he looked at me, I'll never forget that. I said, well, I'll tell you something, Oscar, some leagues, they don't get that.
That's right.
And that always stuck with him. He always told that story on me afterwards. But that's where I got it. And then St. Paul Ball Club, I had some characters there. I had a lot of fellows like Johnny Murphy, who was later general manager up there in the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mets. And I had Dusty Cook and Benny Chapman.
Boy.
And Billy Rogel. And
yeah.
I took care of all those. All those fellows would play for St. Paul. Jack Salsgaver.
Mm-hmm.
And Elmer Miller. And Bubbles Hargrave. And,
great names.
We had some great names.
Yeah.
We had some great ball players.
Yeah.
One year we had over seven fellows hitting over 300 and another year we won over 100, I think about 112 ball game, finished second behind Kansas City.
Cronin
was in Kansas City at that time.
Who was?
Cronin.
Yeah.
And they had some great ball players down
sure.
there.
Sure. I saw Cronin play his first major league game.
Is that right?
Yeah. I happened to be in Forbes Field the day that put him in the lineup.
Yeah.
Then he got traded to Washington very shortly after that.
And I had some characters like Lefty Gomez.
Oh, what a character.
He was a character.
Yeah. Still is.
You ought to see, he joined us in Milwaukee. I think it was 31 or 32. We won the pennant in 31. I think 32 he joined us in Milwaukee, I think. He's Lefty Liefeld from St. Louis here as our manager. And it was on Sunday, he joined us on Sunday, and he didn't have a pair of shoes. We gave a pair of shoes, they were flop shoes, you know. And he was on the bench, and we got a tight game with Milwaukee, and he goes in the ninth inning. We're winning by one run. I'll never forget it. Lefty says, Gomez. And Gomez jumped over and he grabbed the bat. He said, what are you doing with the bat? He says, I thought you wanted me to hit. He says, get down the center field bullpen. You had to go all the way down the center field. You had to go across the field to get down there.
Yeah.
And warm up. He says, looks like we might have to use you. He went down the bullpen, and sure enough, they loaded the bases.
Mm.
Nobody out. Oh. He calls Gomez in. And here he comes across the outfield. Shoes popping. Funny thing. Whistling.
Yeah.
Marching through Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
He came in there, and you see, and it was getting dark. It was Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and it was getting dark, and there was three men on there, and he blew that ball right by him. And the best hitter was Stanton. He was left-hander at first base. He never even come close to a ball. And he struck the side out, and we won the ball game.
Ooh,
that was
what a start.
The start with the
yeah.
And he was then they sent him down for me to put some weight on him. The Yankees sent him down. He weighed about 130, 40 pounds about that time.
Good, good.
Tall kid, you know, gawky. And I remember he had some bad teeth. And they said, get his teeth taken care of. So we had an off day in St. Paul. And I said, hell, I says, you go to the dentist today. He said, what are you going to do? I said, oh, I'm taking an outing with my wife and her sister. He says, I'm going along. I said, you got to go to the dentist. Oh, no. He says, I'm going along with you. We let the dentist wait. I'm going along with you. We took a trip. I don't know if you've been in St. Paul or not, on the St. Paul River. And we went down there on this outing. I don't forget it. And we get down there, and we're fooling around. And finally, says the wife, I said, let's take a boat trip. We look around him. We can't find him. His sister's with us. So I said, shoot, we get on the boat. We're going down the St. Croix River, and the bluffs on either side, a lot of little rocks and everything, and bluffs and that. And the guy says, the guy that was taking us on the boat trip says, look at that crazy guy up there trying to climb up the side of that cliff there. And I said, look, that's Gomez. Holy smokes, I hit, get the boat over there, get over there, I got to get him down. I said, shoot, that's my meal money. I says, hey, get him out of there. He got the boat over the edge, and I hollered up. I says, hey, you crazy, get down off that rock, get down there before I lose my job. Yeah, it's easy, 12 breaks a right, we're in trouble.
Right.
And he came down, he said, what's that? I said, hey, if you happen anything to you, I'm through. I said, you're supposed to be in a dentist today, and here you are, climbing the cliffs. But he was like that.
I don't think he ever changed.
Oh, he never changed. He came in, well, you know what he says? He tells people now when he goes up, I mean, about a few years ago, at a dinner, we were both there, and he was talking about me. He said, hey, this guy gave me my first whirlpool. He stuck my elbow in the toilet bowl and flushed it.
Yeah, I've talked to a lefty on the phone several times.
Have you already?
I never got to him to tape. We kept trying, but he's a busy man these days.
Oh, he's still well listening, isn't
he? Yeah.
Yeah, he does a lot of appearances for him.
I missed him just barely in spring training in Phoenix, and I missed him just barely in San Diego, and I was in San Francisco, and he lives right outside of San Francisco. And when I called him, he was leaving that minute for someplace or other.
Well, they tell me one time with the Yankees in Chicago, he was trying to be funny, you know, and the people next door, and he saw the ledge out there, a ledge. Did he go from one room to another on the ledge?
Yeah.
Wow.
A madman.
Lefty was something else. No, but it was interesting, and I had all those young fellows like Dusty Cook and Benny Chapman that they sent down, that they played the year before at Charlotte or someplace in Class B, and then they sent them to us in AAA the next year. Both those kids were 19 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I remember we played Louisville, and right next door to the Kentucky Hotel there was a burlesque show. So I took the two guys, Chapman and Dusty Cook, they'd never been in a burlesque show before.
Is that right?
So I took them in there, and I says, I bet you guys in. And Dusty, I'll never forget him. All he did, I've never seen like this. I didn't know this was going on, you know. I said, I just let you get it. I said, now don't go off the deep end. I just want you to know what's going on. And Chapman, of course, he played third base. He moved everybody out of the box seats behind first base. He gave the Oscar a fit. I mean, he would see the Yankees put him in the outfield.
Yeah.
I remember first year in the major leagues with Andy, we played right there. I think he stole around 67 the base or something like that, which was high.
Very high.
I think because he told me that fall came down here, he was joining St. Louis University. That same year I joined the ball club down here. They gave me a job down at St. Louis University. I'll tell you about that. Did you hear about that?
Sure.
Well, anyhow, I saw Chapman, and he says, worst mistake I ever made, steal all the bases this year. They're going to expect it of me every year now. He says, gee, he says, I could have just, you know, been not too that good. He told me that. Remember later, he got some problem with Philadelphia's manager of Philadelphia there for a while. They fired him over
there.
Kind of racial. But I really over the years, just I could go down like Durst and Benny Pascal and all those guys. Benny Pascal is the start of those switch hitters. Kind of a designated hitter. He used to play against left-hand pitchers with the Yankees all the time.
Yeah, when they were platooning, beginning that.
Yeah, they started a platoon at that time, right.
Now, tell me, Doc, what year were you born?
1909.
I'm 1 year older.
Are you?
Yeah.
Is that right? 1908? Yeah.
Born in 08. Way down, I was born in Texas.
Up what part of Texas were you born?
Haskell, Texas, a little tiny place up near Abilene and in that area. But we moved when I was pretty young to Corpus Christi for 2 years.
Yeah.
Then my father, who was a state bank examiner, got a job running a bank, a new bank in Laredo. We moved there just for 1 year, and when he got it on the road, they offered him a job in McAllen down in the Rio Grande Valley.
We played exhibition games in McAllen.
Yeah. So that's where I grew up, was in McAllen.
McAllen, did you? Really?
When you mentioned Mineral Wells, hell, all the teams trained down in Texas almost in those years.
Oh, yeah.
They were scattered all over the place.
Yeah. We had an exhibition game. We played Fort Worth on Sunday. It was 90 degrees. Went up to Amarillo the next day. It was 32.
Sure.
The wind never stopped blowing all the time we were there.
Yeah. First game I ever saw major league teams, it wasn't a major league game, but the Cardinals and the Philadelphia Athletics came to our little town in McAllen. I think it was 1919. I was about 11 years old.
Yeah.
But rabid for baseball and knew all the names and everything. And why they ever came to our little town, which wasn't very old, didn't have many people, but they came to play there. They got as many people as you could expect. But anyway, they had to dress about 3 or 4 miles from where they played, and they needed transportation. My father was a banker, and he was one of the local citizens that offered to use his car transporting them. So I was right in there with them, of course. And I don't remember who won the game at all, but I know that coming back after the game, Ricky was managing the Cardinals that for that is
oh,
the first time.
Right. Yeah.
And Hornsby was already established as a star, but he was to rise higher, of course. But riding back to their place after the game, I was in the back seat with Hornsby on one side of me, and I don't remember who on the other side because I only had eyes for Hornsby.
Yeah.
And he said, what's your name, Sonny? And I said, well, everybody calls me Babe. He says, left-handed? And I said, sure am. And he says, maybe you'll grow up to be a great pitcher like Babe Ruth. That was before Ruth had quit pitching, you know.
Yeah.
I said later, well, he made a mighty poor prediction, but it was music to a youngster's ears to hear something like that and to be that close to him. But then my first major league game. I was headed up to Notre Dame, but I was on the way to Pittsburgh where I had relatives. I was going to spend a month with them.
Yeah.
Came up on the train to St. Louis and I arranged it, so I got in here in the early afternoon and left about 7:30 and I took a taxi out to Sportsman's Park and the Browns were playing the Tigers.
Is that right? Yeah.
Boy, was I thrilled. Guys, I didn't know they didn't even have Hall of Fame then, but I saw 5 Hall of Famers my first game. Cobb and Gehringer and Manush and Sisler and
I was talking about Gehringer yesterday. What a ball!
Yeah. Oh, one of the greats. Yeah.
He was great.
Great. Still lives too.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, I went on to Pittsburgh, and they were home most of the time. My relatives lived about 7 blocks from Forbes Field. I was the first one in the park every day, and the Pirates were champions. Had won in 25, and. We're in first place, and the Cardinals came in on Labor Day, right behind them. They split that doubleheader, but the day after, the Cardinals took over first place and went on to the pennant and the famous series win over the Yankees in 26 with Alexander.
Yeah.
So I saw a whole slug of more Hall of Famers, Bottomley and Haynes and Hornsby, and of course I'd seen Hornsby personally before. And Paul Wehner broke in that year in Pittsburgh, so I saw him. Pie Trainer, great gangs. So after you left St. Paul, you came here.
Well, see, I was with St. Louis University. In fact, I was always with the Browns.
But I mean, when you left St. Paul, did you come to St. Louis?
Well, Here's what I did. I used to commute back and forth. In 1928, after, towards the end of the season, I think it was somewhere in the first part of September, latter part of August, Lee Daly was a broker down here in St. Louis, was on head of the board of directors or head of the athletic board at St. Louis University. And they were bringing Hunk Anderson down from Notre Dame to coach St. Louis U. And he brought down Chili Walsh, Bucky Dahman, Christy Flanagan, and all those guys. You remember all those guys?
I was a student when they were heroes.
Well, that's what I mean.
Sure.
They all came down here at football, see, for football.
Yeah.
So now they're looking for a trainer. They didn't have a regular trainer here at St. Louis U. So they're coming in there. So they offered my brother the job. Well, he was with the hockey club in the wintertime. He said, I can't take the job. So Comrie and Daly, who was, I think Daly and Comrie were good friends. Daly was sitting up in the stands with Comrie, and they called me up and says, how would you like to go to St. Louis U this fall, be trainer down there? I said, see, this is too much. It was tough to handle, you know?
Yeah.
And I says, all right, okay, okay, I'll take it. I didn't know what I was getting myself into.
I'll bet.
And you know, the first night I came down here, believe it or not, this actually happened the first night I came down here. They had an SL house down here on Washington Boulevard, right near the funeral parlor, on Lindell Boulevard, right near Donnelly Funeral Parlor there. And all the football players from out of town were housed in this one place. And so when I came in, I got off the train here at around noontime, and Mr. Daly met me. This was after the baseball season. And took me around, showed me the university, the gym and that, and introduced me to the coaches and that. And then they put me up, I remember they made a cot for me down at SL House at night. So if I could find maybe another place to live, I'd sleep in this cot.
Yeah, but the SL stood for St. Louis?
St. Louis University.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, went to bed that night and I'm sleeping right down, right after you come in, right in the room, come in the front door. The coaches are upstairs and that, and the players are all upstairs in this house. Big, big home there on Lindell. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, coach shakes me. He says, I got a sick kid upstairs. So I went up there. You won't believe it, but the guy's still living. He's still a lawyer here in St. Louis. He's sort of retired, Eddie Davidson. So I examined him. I says, you got an acute attack of appendicitis. I says, gee, I can't handle you. You got a, I don't even know who the doctor's name was, the hospital or anything to work with. So I says, Chili Walsh. I says, Chili, I says, this kid's got to go to the hospital. He says, well, we'll take care of it. We'll get him out there. Okay, I went back to bed. 7 o'clock, Chili shakes me again. I said, what? He said, I got another sick kid upstairs.
You're kidding.
A kid by the name of Joe Batkin. Now, he was a kid that lived in St. Louis, was living at the house. And I says, oh, no, this can't be. I said, this kid's got a attack of appendicitis, too.
Yeah.
I said, this can't be. This is my first night on the job.
Oh, boy.
I says, hey. I says, so he's got to go out to the hospital, too. Well, to make it, to shorten up the story, got up the next morning, went up to the gym. We were working out at Grand McLeod at that time. Grand McLeod, which was a circus ground, the old ballpark over there, the circus ground, that's where we were working out. We played our games until the old Sportsman's Park or the old Bush Stadium was ready for us to move in there. We'd play our games at Public High School Stadium, the first two or three games we played. And so we were working out, they would walk up the alley up to Brandon and McLeod there and work out there and come back. Well, I'm in the little training room, not as big as this room here. That was the training room I had at the gym at that time, right next to the shower room.
Good, great.
That's what I had to work in. I had one lamp, and that was it. Nothing else to work with. That's all. And I got 50, 60 ball players, football players to take care of. And here I am. Well, it's a good thing I wasn't experienced, because I didn't know any better. But this is the truth. And about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock that afternoon, Batka comes back from the hospital. And he looks at me, and he looked like, well, he looked like death walking. And Davidson was still in the hospital out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, what'd they say, Joe? He said, they give me a bottle of this white medicine that they told me to come back. He said, that's some indigestion.
Oh,
I said, you're hurting. And he says, I'm in pain. But you get on the table, I found that, geez, I just touch a penny.
Yeah,
so I said, forget it. You go right back to the hospital. You don't belong here.
What they did was the worst thing you can do with appendicitis.
So I go back to the house that night, and I see the Chili Walsh. Hunk Anderson, he didn't stay. He was living with his family, had two daughters. And
mm-hmm.
So Chili, I says, this job's too tough for me. I says, I'm going home. I hadn't even unpacked my bag. I says, I'm going to go home. He said, now wait a minute, Bob, wait a minute. This is an unusual thing. This may never happen again, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, forget it. I said, this job, I'm not ready for this job. I said, this is beyond me. He said, don't you do a thing. About that time, the telephone rang, and the call from the hospital, and Father Reagan was our athletic moderator and director mm-hmm. at that time. And he says, come on out to the hospital. They're going to do emergency operations on both kids tonight. Operated on both of them.
Yeah.
Chili left the house. He said, don't you make a move till I get back here. Said to me, because I said, I'm ready to go home. Get a midnight train back to Twin Cities. So I waited till he came back. He says, they operate on both kids. Both kids are going to be fine. He says, you unpack your bag. Stay here. I'll guarantee you this may never happen again. And he was right. It wasn't until years later that I had Hal Smith up in Milwaukee that attacked appendicitis. We brought him home and flew him home from Milwaukee and went out to Jewish Hospital and Dr. Millman operated on him. That was the next case I had.
Is that right?
Hal Smith, yeah. So,
well, you owe Chili a debt of gratitude for keeping you here then. You go home, who knows what you're doing.
That's right. I don't know what the future would have been. I don't know what the future would have been. So then I stayed here for 50 years. I commuted from 1928 to 1935. I'd commute back and forth. I got married that fall of 1928.
Mm.
I got married that fall. Later on in the fall, I got married.
Mm-hmm.
And a girl from St. Paul. But in 1935, we had an incident happen with Bad. She was carrying youngster at the time. We were down here for, I think, her football and then figure on going back to St. Paul and mm-hmm. spending with the St. Paul Ball Club. And which I did, I've been doing this for about 8-9 years now.
Sure.
And she had attacked appendicitis, another appendicitis case, mm-hmm. took her to the hospital and they operated on her. We didn't have any antibody drugs at the time.
Yeah.
She developed septicemia. They didn't realize it at the time, but she was carrying a pneumonia bug, and she never made it. So I was left with two children. One was, well, the day she was buried, my youngest one was 2 years old.
Oh my goodness.
And the other one was 5.
I lost an older brother by that same thing.
Did you really?
Yeah, peritonitis after appendicitis operation.
That's what happened to her.
He was 19 when it happened.
Peritonitis and septicemia, and that was it. Same thing, the very same thing. Well, you know what it's all about.
Yeah.
So now I'm on a loss. But I had one here, Dr. Kopkitz, who was a physiatrist, and I've been working with him in physical therapy at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to me, he got a hold of me, and he says, oh, you know what you're going to do? You're going to go back to school. And you're going to stay here at St. Louis U. You're going back to school and stay at St. Louis U. But he finally convinced me. I mean, he talked like a Dutch uncle and that. And he says, I want you to go back and study physical therapy. I says, okay. So he enrolled me. I got enrolled at St. Louis U.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to spring training and 35 with the St. Paul Ball Club. I finished the season at 35. Well, 35 was when my wife died. 36 I went to spring training. We trained down in Florida. I'd got it, I don't know whether you know Jackie Warner or not. He became great friends. Jackie Warner, he was a major league infielder.
Yeah, shortstop.
That's right. Yeah. And later a scout for years, He lived out on the coast. He just died here a couple of years ago. His wife still lives at Mount Vernon, Illinois. She was originally from there. And anyhow, I came back to St. Louis U and enrolled in the university. I had made up my credits, you know, High school, so I had all those high school credits, but I went to night school.
Sure.
Back to when, 28, 29, I got my degree, high school degree in 1929. And so I went back and studied physical therapy, and that was a struggle. I went to spring training and spent the summer here, and later on that year I got, in the fall of the year, Ricky called me and offered me a job with the Cardinals. And I says, what am I going to do? He says, well, I want you to go to spring training, handle spring training. We got a whole new camp opening up, he says, and a lot of minor leaguers, and we're bringing in about 400 minor leaguers. I want you to sort of help and supervise and run the camp. I said, what do you got for me afterwards? He said, well, I'm not sure yet. And you're not sure. I said, well, let me think about it. I go home. I haven't been home a couple hours. The telephone rings again. The Browns asked me to come out.
Uh-huh.
Bill Lee, one of the Browns, says, can I talk to you? Bob, will you come out? I want to talk to you. He offered me the job at St. Louis Browns as a major league trainer. See, Ricky, well, I wouldn't be a major league trainer because Dr. Weaver was still here with
me. Sure.
And so they offered me a job, a good contract. In those days, to me, was a good contract. And I says, what about my St. Louis University? He says, you go right back to St. Louis, you again, stay with them, and stay in school. I said, well, that's great.
Sure.
He says, I'll take the job. Sure.
Couldn't beat that.
Yeah, and the following fall, funny thing, Don Barnes, who owned the St. Louis Browns, he gave a party out of his place. Well, I'll have to tell you about that, too. It was towards the end of the season, and I ran into Ricky. Ricky said, are you satisfied with the Browns? He says, you still got a job with the Cardinals if you want it. I said, no, Mr. Ricky. I says, I'm real satisfied with the Browns. He was a guest out at Barnes' place.
Yeah.
I met him on a winding staircase going upstairs. He had a big place out Chesterfield there.
Uh-huh.
He had an estate out there, you know.
Yeah.
And Barnes, and I met Ricky on the steps, and that's when he asked me if I was satisfied with Browns. He still wanted to hire me.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Were you still with him when they won the pennant?
Oh, sure. 16 years with the Browns.
One of the people I talked with in my book was Luke Sewell.
I want to tell you something about that. Talk about Luke Sewell. Let me tell you a story about that before I go into Satchel Paul. Oh, I guess.
That's great.
I could be. Luke Sewell, 44, came into me just before the opening of the season. And he says, we trained at Cape Girardeau that year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he says to me, Bob, he says, we got a rough, tough ball club, but we got a good shot maybe to win this pennant this year. I says, so? He says, we go on the road with this option that we got. He says, I want somebody to check them every night.
Mm-hmm.
I says, well, I never checked any major league players. I says, hell, anybody ever come checking any major league players before? Is it maybe one or two guys that check them?
Yeah.
He says, well, he says, I hate to get somebody from the outside to do it. He says, I'd rather have somebody like you do it. I said, well, let me think about it. I'll take it home with me and think about it. I'll let you know tomorrow. He says, well, it's okay.
Right.
So I got to thinking about it. I always checked it. We'd go on the road with the football team at the university or basketball players. I always checked them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
On a pretense, I'd bring them an apple or something to say that, check them at midnight to see if anybody would see it.
Right.
But with college boys, it was a lot different, you know.
Sure.
And they might go off the deep end on you, just like today, with dope and all that. And,
yep.
And then remember in the 40s there, and late 40s and then 50s, they had the fixing the points and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I came back the next day. go right back to Sewell again. I said, Luke, I want to talk to the players. I want to talk to them. At the meeting today, get them all together, I want to talk. Mm-hmm. He says, okay. So I got a little ballpark up there, upstairs clubhouse. And I said, fellas, your manager thinks he can win the pennant this year. And he's concerned about some of you boys. So he's asked me to check you in when we go on the road. And I'm going to consent to do it. And I says, I want your cooperation. I'll only do it on one condition. Now, if there's any of you got any beef, give it to me now. Because when I check your room, I don't want any guff from you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm putting it right on the table to you. And I said, if you got anything to say, let's say it now.
Yeah.
You could have heard a pin drop. There wasn't one guy that said anything. I said, anybody got anything to say? I said, don't remember what I said. I don't want any guff from you when I check you in. Never had a problem.
Wonderful.
Never had a problem. We were independent.
Yeah. I listened by radio in my home in South Bend to that last game.
And we had
Chet Labs hit a couple out. And
Jack Kuki. Oh,
yeah.
I can tell you a story. Jack Kuki. You know,
Sig?
You know, say it. Before the last game, we won to beat the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
They were staying at the Melbourne Hotel out of them. Zach Taylor was a coach then.
Mm-hmm.
And Zach was telling me the next morning, Sunday morning, he says, you know, he says, that's a cookie, I don't know about him. I said, what do you mean? He says, he walked into the lobby last night carrying a bag of liquor bottles. He was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
I says, yeah, I said, I'll talk to him. And you know, Jacuki came up to me, and he was, Jacuki, good friend, he liked me. I never had a problem with him. He was good to me. He was a wild guy. He was rough, tough. He was rough, tough. He'd been in the service, you know, and he came up to me, and this is before the game now, getting him ready to go out and pitch the last game.
Mm-hmm.
I says, Sig, you got anything to say to me? He started giggling. He says, yeah. He says, you know, he says, last night, he says, Taylor, I was walking in the lobby, and I had a bag full of Taylor stopper. I said, what do you mean? I knew the story.
Sure.
He says, well, you wouldn't have did that. I says, I told him, no. I says, I'm not going to take a drink tonight at all. I said, I'm not going to touch this up. I promise you. He says, I've had a few this morning already. It's a hell of a ball game.
Yeah, yeah.
We beat them 5-2.
Yeah,
one pennant.
Yeah. Now Dutch Leonard told me, he's another one I talked with, that he beat whatever team he beat.
Them. Detroit.
Yeah, he beat Detroit.
Pitcher for Washington.
Pitched a great game.
Oh,
beat him, and so they invited him and his wife to come down to the celebration here.
Right.
And Luke Sewell told me that after that win, he went over and Barnes was in the box seat right there. He said, went over and Barnes was crying just like a baby. He was so emotional.
Oh, yeah. He was emotional. Barnes wasn't. He came to the clubhouse, hugged me, cried on my shoulder. Oh, shoot, yeah. He was emotional.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Shoot. No, and then Jacuki, he was fine.
Were you still here when Vec took over the Browns?
Yep.
I mean, with the Browns, you were with them.
Yep.
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 How was that?
Satchel Paige.
Then get into Satchel. Yep.
Oh, Satchel. Now, here was a very intelligent man. I mean, he could speak a couple of languages.
Yeah.
He could dance. He could play instruments. He was really knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. Evidently, he must have done that already. And he roomed across me on the Pullman all the time.
Uh-huh.
He had a berth across from me. You wouldn't believe this, but he would answer his correspondence at night on that Pullman, and he'd typewriter actually all night.
Portable typewriter.
Little small typewriter, hot
sure.
Book, and do a lot of correspondence. But that's the only thing he'd do. He'd bring fish. And then he'd have the porter bring him a couple of pails, and he'd clean those fish. Now this is on the Pullman. across from me, right across from my brother. Well, I loved him. Satch liked me, and I liked Satch. He was a very, very good man. Why don't I tell you some of those stories? Some of the things that he did. People, this isn't well known. Satch would clean these pigs and give them to the porter and say, take them up there and I'll have them for breakfast. Mm-hmm. Which he would do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, he was so knowledgeable. Like Frank Saucier, S-A-U-C-I-E-R.
Yes.
He was a cum laude for a graduate from college, a smart guy. Mm-hmm. He got Satch on a train one day, a Pullman, I'll never forget this. I just happened to be going by, he's talking to Satch. He said, Satch, you're pretty smart. He says, on Noah's Ark, what were the doors made out of? Satch says, made out of oak. Frank looked at him. And Satch says, I got a question for you. He said, what were the hinges made out of?
Sorry. He couldn't answer.
He couldn't answer. And he said, you were made out of leather.
That's right.
I mean, that's how he was.
Yeah.
Now, another time we're in the clubhouse, and Satch was always the last one to take a shower. You know, he was always kind of embarrassed going with the rest of the white guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it always waits. So one day, the guys had a contest in there, and they got soap trays about 4 to 5 inches, you know, those soap trays that you have with small bars of soap, And they had a contest, and then the players and Courtney and those guys were trying to toss them in this tray, see?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody could do it, see? Satch is out there, and they're playing, and finally he got sick and tired of waiting, you know, mm-hmm. to get out of there, and so he went in the shower room. And of course, Courtney got Satch right away and says, hey, Satch, you're always got the great control. He said, let's see what you can do with that soap. So Satch just, well, satisfied. He took the bottle like that. Stuck. And you know, they've been trying for 15, 20 minutes trying to make it. And they said, oh, you couldn't do it again. By God, if he didn't take it
together.
And you know what he says? He says, you know, I just don't know what else I can do until I try it.
That's right.
And
that's
exactly right. Right. Now, Courtney got him another deal. Courtney says, Satch, he says, you got the strong arm. He says, I want to tell you what to do. Let's bet $10. We got a contest. He says, you go behind the plate, I'll go on first base. Take my lead, you won't throw me out at second base, $10. He shook his head. Courtney was crazy.
Yeah.
And Satch said, what's the deal? He said, well, another one is you go shortstop. They'll hit a ball to you, I'll run from the plate, you won't throw me out of first base.
Hmm.
And Satch said, he says, the third one is fumble ball to the outfield, I'll tag up at third base and you won't throw me out. $10 on each one.
Satch wins all three.
Oh, jeez. He won them in a breeze. He threw him out of second base by 10 feet. He threw him out of first base. He wasn't even close.
Yeah.
And the ball that they hit to the outfield was almost to the fence. That was a long ball, and he threw him out at home plate.
Wow. What a guy.
What a guy.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Marty Marion told me when he managed the Mignon in the early 50s.
Yeah. Well, he managed us in 53. Yeah.
He said,
52, 53.
I didn't manage Satch. Satch managed you.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd come in, you know, I could tell you, I know about the honesty stuff. He was fishing, they all kill him about fishing.
Mm-hmm.
He brought in the biggest fish I've ever, big bullhead I've ever.
True.
I never saw one that big. He put it in the shower room and all those guys, they couldn't believe it. The audience was popping out about how big the fish he got.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
He came in one day and he said, and he brought this fish back in. And he said, put it in the shower room. I never saw one that big.
Jeez.
I never saw a big bullhead that big. I never saw one.
Yeah.
What we call a freshwater bullheads, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I never saw one that big. Must have weighed 300 pounds, I guess. I don't know. It was a big one.
Wow.
And he brought that in. He left it in the shower room there for all the guys to look at. He said, I just want to let you know that I was out fishing.
Oh, boy.
First time I saw Satch, it was up at St. Paul Ball Club. And he was we didn't know who he was. He says they got a pitcher, black pitcher up there in Dakota, says that he can really throw. And we went barnstorming at the end of the season. Giuliani was the catcher with us at that time. He was just breaking in. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of the St. Paul ball club, and they had a few amateurs, went up and played exhibition game up in Dakota against Sats. Dads came up there. And he was pitching on the Sunday night when he struck out 18. You get a lot of foul off of
it. I can believe it, yeah.
That's the first time I saw Sats.
Yeah.
I told him about it later on. I always said, Sats, we beat you that day. Oh, gee, you don't want to see me. He was great. He could do that Bojangle. Remember Bojangle Rousing?
Yeah.
He could imitate him to a T.
Okay.
He could dance. Sats could do it. He's such an intelligent man. I got pictures of him at home taken with him. He's terrific.
It's too bad that they don't really know how many games he won everywhere that he pitched, because he pitched so many places, so many years. He and Cool Papa Bell were over in the Dominican Republic a lot, along with Dandridge and others, some of whom are now in the Hall of Fame. And their names are still right on the tip of everybody's old-timers' tongues over in the Dominican Republic, I'll tell you, because they played over there a number of seasons.
You talk about, I just saw a picture of Berardino the other day on the picture. Day, I tell you about, we were out at Barnes' place, remember?
Mm-hmm.
We saw Ricky that day.
Yeah.
Well, they had a movie that night. And in that movie, something like Four Feathers or Three Feathers was an English picture.
Mm-hmm.
And the fella does a soliloquy or something like that, talking about, and he says, water, Peter, water, or something like that. And Berardino, he was frustrated. At that time, he was a frustrated actor. He was with the comedy, the kids, our gang kids.
Yes.
You know, he had some movies done with them. And so Harlan Cliff locker is here, like over here. My table, rubbing table, is here in the old clubhouse, the old Browns clubhouse, if they ever renovated it.
Mm-hmm.
And the table's right here, and Berardino's on the table. Cliff, he gets a bucket of water, and he intimidates John, saying, can you imitate what that fellow said last night on the Three Feathers about that? And John there, yeah, and he gets to that water, Peter water, and about that time, his eyes are closed, water, Peter, Cliff hits him with that bucket of water. I mean, all over. I don't think he ever forgot it. But that Harlan Cliff, he was like that. You talk about friends. He hit him with that bucket of water. Water, Peter, water. I'll never forget that. I just thought about that last night in bed. I said, because I'd seen John's picture. I saw him on Denver Hospital the other day. Now he's a grandfather or something. I don't know. He got him on there now.
Yeah, he's made quite a career out of that.
Oh, has he ever?
A lot more career out of that than he did with baseball.
Yeah, I talked to him on the phone about 2 years ago. He called here when they get a uniform. They had an Italian reunion in Chicago, and we had a brown uniform around. I think we found one and sent it to him.
Yeah, Bill Borst could find one for you, I bet. You know Bill?
Bill, sure. Yeah. Whoa. Well, you know, you could go on telling stories about these guys, the great ball players that we had. That I had Newsom, gee, of all the guys.
Old Bobo.
You know, he had some. When he left here, I used to get on him all the time. I think he went over to Detroit, was pitching for them.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the mound one day, and George McQuinn was playing with us still a little bit. And I said, George, he says, here's some scraps of paper. When you come back from first base next time, and what was it? Throw all these scraps of paper on the mound. I said, we may be here half the night, but I said, throw them on the mound. Sure enough, Bo walked on the mound. He saw this. He made me pick up every scrap of paper. And the 44 Club, we had, hey, that's the wildest group of fellas I've ever been around.
I can.
But when they got on the field, you could. Yeah. They you could. They, we won 9 in a row. Remember that year mm-hmm. we started out winning mm-hmm. first nine ball yeah. games, and that sort of set the tune, the pattern for the whole year. And we really had some some ball game. Like Dykes was see who was managing the White Sox when they hit that.
Probably Dykes.
And he had a guy that came out of the service sitting next to him. Put him in uniform, and all they'd do, and you know, this guy would agitate. He'd call our guys obscene names and all that stuff. So we were getting fed up with it. And George Castor, he came in to relieve a pitch. Mm-hmm. And the guys told him what was going on. And this guy always sit next to Dykes, right on the bench. And Castor wound up, never threw the plate, threw right to the dugout. And all of our guys charged their dugout when he did that. Mm-hmm. Hayworth was the first one in there, and he grabbed this guy, and he hit him, and knocked him underneath. It was, I don't know if you remember the old dugouts we had.
No.
He knocked him underneath there, mm-hmm. And then there was an areaway underneath there, a concrete flooring. And he hit him, and Clary was right after him. Ellis Clary, mm-hmm. he was on our club at that time, that championship club. And he starts stomping him with his spikes. Oh, geez, tore his uniform apart. Well, that was the end of him. I mean, the president got to Dykes, and Dykes has got up, he's up on the water cooler, hollering, please, please, hit the police, you know. No, I mean, this is, it was a hell of a deal.
Oh, boy.
And they finally had to carry the guy out on a stretcher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He asked for it and he got it.
He got it. Oh, that Castor bit over him and they killed him with the ball. It went right between his head and Dyke's head.
Yeah.
He threw it, instead of throwing it to the plate, he threw it in the dugout.
Yeah. Wow.
George.
I've never heard of that happening before.
No. No.
Probably hasn't happened since.
No, right. Cat Castor was, when we had Pete Gray, you know? Castor, he got into, we were playing next week in game, Toledo, we're leaving there.
Yeah.
And Castor had a couple of fish or something, I don't know where he got them from. And he threw them in Pete Gray's pocket. At first, Pete didn't know what was going on. Then when he found the fish in there, in his pocket, oh, geez, he started to charge Castor. It was right on the depot in Toledo. And Castor put one arm behind him. He says, come on, let's go at it. He got to battle him with a laugh. You got to pull him apart.
Oh, boy.
I think that's been told in a story somewhere along the line. That was something else.
How was Jack Kramer?
Kramer? Oh, they used to play tricks on him.
Too. Did they?
Oh, so you. What the nastiest one was, he used to bring his own drinks out to the game all the time. And what the hell they call these things? The screw on top.
Thermos bottle?
Thermos bottle. I think it was thermos bottle. Keep it cold.
Mm-hmm.
One day, I don't want to go too far with this, but the guys took a leak into the bottle and did that, put it back in there.
did he taste the difference?
Oh, jeez. He wanted to find, and he was strong. Now, let me tell you another thing. He was strong.
I'm sure.
Yeah, and Sam Arshaney, he challenged him one day in the clubhouse. And the two of them had to stop it. He had killed Arshaney.
Sure you did.
Yeah, Arshaney got on him, Sam, the catcher, the Browns at that time.
Yeah.
He was from across the river, East St. Louis, I think. And I forget what he did to Kramer, but I mean, boy, they really got into a battle.
Wow.
But there was another battle that we had up there when Haney was manager.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Haney, you know, remember Vern Kennedy?
He pitched for the White Sox, so.
Bernie Tebbets.
Yeah.
He was pitching one day, and he was pitching, and Tevis, he was a jockey. He was riding, rode all through the game.
Mm-hmm.
He was really on him, calling all the names of the world. See. Kennedy was mad. I mean, he was mad. He came out early the next day, waiting for Tevis to show up downstairs. They had a clubhouse downstairs, and the clubhouse was downstairs.
Yeah.
And he kept sending the bat boy down there all the time, tell me when he comes in, tell me when he comes in. Kennedy had been sleeping on this all night.
Yeah.
And Kennedy, you know, he won that in Philadelphia, the decathlon or something, that, or pentathlon, but decathlon. He was, hard as rocks. And he still lives down here in Missouri. You know?
Mm-hmm.
He comes up here for the Senior Olympics every year. But as soon as the kid came up, says, Tevis is down there, he went downstairs. Tevis was sitting on the stool. He walked over to him and he says, I don't like those things. But I don't know exactly his words because I wasn't there.
Sure.
But he says, get up on the stool. Grabbed him by the goddamn collar and got him up off there and then hit him. I mean, he hit him, knocked him right on his can.
Oh boy.
And walked out. Tevis hit him. And Haney heard about it. He came up, I've never met him, Fred Haney, he liked to fight. He was a fighter, Fred was.
Mm-hmm.
Fred come up, he said, move all, tell the clubhouse, move all the trunks back, we're going to have a battle up here. He says, that Tevis is going to come up here and going to fight that Kennedy. We're going to see something. Well, Tevis had York. I think it was York was with him at that time, or York, something like that. I think it was Rudy York. Anyhow, he was the champion. Well, I know York came up with him. He was good with Tevis.
Yeah.
And Baker was the manager.
Dale?
Right? Was Baker?
Dale Baker?
Yeah, Dale Baker was the manager.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we never got the thing started much to Haney's
disgust.
Haney wanted to see those battle. And up comes Baker. Before they ever got there, they just about ready to square off.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes up and he says, that's all. Get down here or I'm going to find the whole damn bunch of you. He says, some of the ball players. Ball club. And he went back. He took him back downstairs. But then Kennedy would have killed him. He would have killed him. He was in such better shape.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez.
You're not related to the old pitcher Frank Baumann, are you?
No.
No.
No, I took care of Frank, a lot of times. In fact, I had a write-up in the Boston newspaper about treating him and he told him how I treated his arm and got him back in shape again and all that,
Mm-hmm. Glenn Wright was the old Pirate shortstop in Brooklyn. He was a scout for the Red Sox when Baumann was making such a promise, and he signed him. And they had an immense hope for him, but I guess he got a bad arm real fast and never lived up to his promise.
You know, there's so many things. Many things. I can go on and on. Like I say, like pills.
Yeah.
I've had, in 64, I knew we had a chance to win the pennant in 64.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking for gimmicks. I learned this from Dr. Weaver. He said, Bob, you got to use some gimmicks sometimes to help these ball players along.
Okay.
And he taught me that. And I thought about some gimmicks that I might use in 64. First of all, believe it or not, Dr. Will that I had worked with during the war at Scum and Steel, I was holding down four jobs at Luther Brown's, going to school, working with the university, worked with Scum and Steel. I was working on my thesis at that time because I was going to get my degree in physical therapy. It took me 12 years. I was going part-time all the time. So they gave me access to all the files out there at Scum and Steel Company because my thesis was on industrial injuries, physical therapy and industrial injuries. Still on file with the library at St. Louis U.
Good.
The Dr. Will was a doctor out there at that time. And he had retired, I'm going back down in 64, and he had retired down south down in Florida, Naples, Florida. And so I says, he was up here visiting in about May. I says, Doctor, I says, would you like to go along with a little gimmick with me? He says, what is that? I says, start sending some cards in from down there and making predictions. And I said, I'll put them on the board. Mm-hmm. And I says, you're pretty knowledgeable about baseball and these players. I says, let's try it. So he took the name of P.P. Latour. Hey, I got to get there. I'll get those cards. I got some. I've saved some of those.
Good.
He said, I'll get them for you if you'd like to see them.
Yeah, I would.
And he sent those cards, and every day I put them up the board. So-and-so's going to do this, so-and-so's going to do that. Like Flood, he's going to get the two or three hits today or something like that. And some of these things are coming true, see?
Okay.
This guy's going to have a good series. This pitcher's going to pitch a shutout, that. And these guys were looking for these cards.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, it got so that Dick Young, sports writer,
yeah,
in New York,
yeah,
we even went to Florida after we won the pennant, and they're looking for P.P. Latour. Everybody thought it was a strip dancer that I had dated sometime and a fortune teller. Mm-hmm. And he started looking for it down there, not knowing that this was a male. Dr. Willard was doing a sign of P.P. Oh, then you never knew about that.
No.
Oh, it was in the papers. Yeah. P.P. Latour. Yeah.
Interesting.
Oh. So that was one of my gimmicks.
Mm-hmm.
That worked great. So then I started putting some pills out there in the table. And I put hitting pills, RBI pills, shutout pills for the pitchers. Only for the pitchers, shutout pills. Placebos.
Yeah.
And they started taking them. Well, the pill thing started, let me tell you where the pill thing started too, before I go on with this.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Partee, remember him, the catcher?
Mm-hmm.
He was with us in the bottom. I said to one, I said, you know, ball players are billable as hell. I said, they believe anything, some of these guys. And Partee, what do you mean? I said, you know what, I could put some pills out there, sex pills. And I said, I'll bet they wouldn't last a day.
Right.
And Partee says, you're kidding. Well, let's put a little wager on them. Hey, how about a $10 wager? I said, I'll put some out there. You spread the word around quietly that I got some new pills or sex pills, and I said, you watch them disappear. Well, the first day I did that, we came in after the game, there was a pill in the bottle. During the ball game, the guy, was stealing a pill.
Mm-hmm.
So I put them out again. It happened again. Roy Partee said, I can't believe this. So I said, well, I'll put the clubhouse guy on it. I said, I'll find out who's doing it. Well, you know, do you remember Freddie Huffman, our coach?
Don't think so.
Freddie Huffman, everybody knew. Freddie was with the Yankees for years in the 20s.
Huffman.
Freddie Huffman. Our coach, yeah. Hoffman.
Yeah.
He was from St. Louis. Well, he was one of the guys stealing the pills. I had to go, and he says, that Huffman comes up there, he takes a handful of them. Freddie was up in years then.
And he needed some help.
He needed some help. But that is the best story, the best one he's ever spread. And Brian Stevens, I think a pitcher that we had at the time, his wife, he's trying to get his wife pregnant, living. And he had her to the doctor and everything, nothing happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I had those pills there. I'll be damned if he didn't give him to his wife. he took some.
Yeah.
And he got her pregnant. Opened the doctor and spent a lot of money and everything.
Yeah.
mind over matter.
Yeah,
don't get it. And Partee never forgot that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the next best thing that happened. We're going up to Boston. Pellegrini's playing shortstop for us. He hadn't been home since spring training. He got a beautiful blonde wife, Pellegrini. He said, Bob, he says, he came up with me, we're going into Boston, New York. He says, would you mind giving me some of those pills? I said, what do you mean? He said, "Well, I'd like to stay up all night." I says, "Well, sure, I'll give you something." I said, "I gave you some pills." Came back the next day, he says, "You know, it didn't work. I fell asleep in a short period of time." I said, "You did? How'd you take them?" "Oh," I said, "you took them all wrong. Now here's the way you want to take them." See, so I just switched the dosage on him. Mm-hmm. He came back the next day, "Geez," he says, "it worked right." He paid me the $10.
Sure.
He still talks about it today. He says, I never told Stevens about it. He says, "If I ever tell him, he'd kill me." Yeah, right. But the gimmicks worked. I had those. That's what I got the idea.
Psychological.
Those guys came in every day and take them. And mm-hmm. Terrific.
Yeah.
Pitchers were pitching shutouts. We had more shutouts pitched that year. I'm telling you.
Jeez. That's tremendous.
I got to get those cards. I got them in a drawer at home and get some of those cards, show you some of those cards. Yeah, I saved a lot of those cards that Dr. Wilson. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're in Pittsburgh. We just got beat a tough game in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. It's going down that half. We got five games in Pittsburgh. We got a couple of doubleheaders in there. Mm-hmm. For the first game, we hadn't heard from Fifi Latour. We hadn't heard from Fifi.
Yeah.
There's a phone right in the middle of the clubhouse. A phone right there. My training table's there at the old Pittsburgh Forbes Field. Mm-hmm. And this is just before, after infield. Everybody's in the clubhouse. And the telephone rang. And I says, "Hey, Fifi Latour on the phone." Fifi says, "We're going to sweep the series." "No, we just lost a tough extra inning ball game in Philly. We're going to sweep the series. So-and-so's McCartney's going to do this. Flood's going to do this. White's going to do this."
It worked out that way.
Worked out.
Yeah. Just give them that little extra something and the confidence that they can do it.
When Housen was here in the 1950s, now, some people may be dying. This actually happened. But I studied hypnotism. I belonged to the group here at that time, associate member of the hypnotism in St. Louis. We had dentists, doctors, and everybody in this science. Mm-hmm. So I studied it with a fellow from psychiatrist and psychologist. I studied with him, and they accepted me into the hypnotist. So the first time I really tried it, San Francisco, Perry pitches a no-hit game. Washington's pitching the next day. Weak pull hypnotism. I got Washington on the table. I said, "I'll tell you something, Ray. Look at me. You're going to pitch a no-hitter today." Mm-hmm. "You're going to pitch a no-hitter. Believe me. You're going to have no hits. Go out there and pitch."
And he did?
No hit. I think there was one mention of it, I think, in the paper. I think I may still have the paper at home.
Cool.
I know I got that. I'm quite sure I got the paper at home that I called and turned on. They just said I called and turned on.
Yeah.
But I tried to hypnotize him.
You put it in his mind?
I put it right in his mind. Wakeful hypnotism.
Only times ever happened in Major League history.
Now, one other thing that I did, and it scared me, and I never used it after that. We're in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you the guy's name, he's still living, he probably won't even remember it. Brolio. I said, "Brolio, you're going out tonight and pitch one hell of a ball game, but you're going to give him one run." We go the ninth inning. We're winning 2-0. He gets a first hitter. Hmm. He goes to second base on an out. I think he wild pitched in the third base. And he scored on the fly ball, and that's the only run they got.
Can you beat that?
2-1. And I quit. I said,
"Yeah.
I said, it scares me.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It scares me. I said, I'm not going to do it.
That was when Ernie was still winning games.
Yeah.
Before the famous trade.
Yeah. Oh, you know that trade?
Sure.
I'm in Houston, club's in Houston. Bing Devine called me 7 o'clock in the morning. Bob, we just made the trade. We got, we're sending Brady Cubs for Brock. I said, who's Brock? You know? And he says, yeah. I said, well, you're getting rid of a pitcher that's not going to do any good. I says, he's got elbow chips. And I says, hey, he's damaged goods. I told Bing before, and that's why we got rid of him.
Yeah. Well, he didn't do any good, that's right.
And dropped him in the pennant boards.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I talked to Bing a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
About that trade, and then when he goes to the Mets, how he was involved in signing Seaver and Kuzman and Nolan Ryan, and
yeah.
Had a nice chat with Bing.
Stories galore.
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
That's what...
Did you read McCarver's book?
No, not yet.
No.
I will.
It's that.
Is it?
Oh, well. Is that supposed to... Oh, jeez.
That's too bad.
Yeah, I this, I that, and you ripped some guys, or friends of mine, who ripped some...
I'm sorry to hear that.
He ripped, Bob Burns, he rips Bob Burns.
Did he really?
Yeah. Joe Schultz, geez, crackers, he says, he shouldn't have, I mean, I don't know whether the fellow writing the book just... made up a lot of this crap, yeah. Or not, I don't know.
You never know.
And some of the language you used in there is bad. I mean, it's a fuck this, fuck that, and I mean, it's
That goes on all the time, but you don't have to put it in the book.
Well, no, I hope you don't put anything like
that. Oh, hell no.
Jeez.
Hell would be the worst either, put in the book, yeah.
You know, the education you have and the background you got, I don't expect that of
you. No, not at all. I think a lot of those guys, when they get with a ghostwriter or when they give a long talk, some of those writers are looking for, I got to get out of here pretty soon, too.
Yeah, I have some stories of Nelson Potter.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
But
about the time
even Ozzy, in his recent interview with GQ, you never know, but I think Ozzy's probably truthful in saying he didn't say some of those things that got in there.
You know, that hypnotist, you know where I got the idea from? Tracy, when we had him with the Browns. Remember Tracy? I could tell you stories on Tracy, hypnotizing.
What was his first name, or do you remember?
David, wasn't it?
No, I don't remember Tracy. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, he was a... First, Charlie DeWitt met him, and Bill DeWitt met him in New York. He came up to their suite, they were there for some meetings, and Tracy came up there, and one of the wives had a headache. I guess it was Charlie's wife, so he says, well, I'll cure that. And he hypnotized her, cured the headache. So Charlie came back here, and he said, Bob, he says, would you mind if maybe we hire that guy for spring training? What do you think about it? Give him some thought. I says, well... And I thought we had one first baseman that could really maybe could use a little hypnotism. But I didn't know anything about hypnotism at that time, but I thought maybe it might work. So I said, go ahead, bring him a spring training. Mm-hmm. So we did. We trained out in California.
Yeah.
And he brought him in there. And the first baseman wouldn't have anything to do with him. I'm trying to think of his name now. Jeez, I'm thinking of it. But he didn't have anything to do with it, you know. But meanwhile, Tracy, he got himself in solid. He started hypnotizing, had classes and that.
Hmm.
And he had a fellow by the name of Owen Friend. He was from across the river here, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he hypnotized him one day, said, you want to hit 2 home runs? Well, he never hit a home run in a long time. He hit 2 home runs that day. So help me.
Thank God.
So you get to thinking, well, there's something to it. That's mm-hmm. where I got the idea. That's why I went to study it later on.
Yeah.
When in the 50s, where hypnotism was really coming into its own. And that's when I studied it.
Hmm.
But he finally got so that the guys put him on. Some guys put him on. We had a young pitcher who had a sore arm.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't ask the pitcher which arm was sore. He said, "Oh, you'll be able to throw this hard before." Well, he was talking about the wrong arm on the guy all the time. And that didn't work out too good.
No.
You know what I mean? And then finally, Zach Taylor was the manager. He wanted to go on the coaching line, and that finished him. Zach said, "There's no way. Get him out of here." And that was the other trades. But I could tell you more stories on him.
Uh-huh.
But if you've got to get out of here.
Pretty soon.
I think Nelson Potter,
yeah.
when he was pitching, and the big umpire from down here played with the football with Cal Hubbard.
Yeah, Hubbard.
You remember?
Yeah, sure.
We remember he caught him. He got Potter was pitching one day. You know, they'd always shoot him throwing his football.
Yeah.
And Potter was pitching one day, and he finally he threw him out of the game. Potter said something. He suspended him for 10 days. That's when Potter went home and got a wife pregnant and got a baby boy and called it after Cal.